world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm your host, Ore Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world. Much to the chagrin of climate activists, demand for oil is actually growing. Undoing dependency on the stuff will take several decades and the right kinds of policies. One place to start? Finding ways to at least use oil more efficiently. And a tribute to Amnon Weinstein, the Israeli luthier whose concerts sought to honour the lives of those lost in the Holocaust. But first, today marks 1 year since the arrest in Russia of Evan Gershkovich, an American journalist. He was accused of spying, a charge vigorously denied by the Wall Street Journal, his employer, the American government, and Mr. Gershkovich himself. Since then, he has been in Lefortovo prison in Moscow, where people are held before trial. We know a bit about what happens in that prison from the family members of current detainees and from the accounts of former residents. Inmates are strip-searched and quarantined, confined to cells fitted with video cameras and with lights that are never dimmed. They are not allowed to make any phone calls and can only communicate with the outside world through their lawyers whenever they are allowed to visit, and with handwritten letters when they're permitted paper and pen. But prisons like Lefortovo are just one part of Russia's infamous penal system.
It's important to know about Russian penal colonies and about Russian prisons. For one, because in Russia people think about it a lot. A lot of people have been through prisons.
Arkady Ostrovsky is The Economist's Russia and Eastern Europe editor, and he's been investigating the conditions of Russia's penal system.
And obviously, we've been hearing a lot about Russian penal colonies because of Alexei Navalny, who died in a penal colony in the Arctic, where he was effectively murdered on the 16th of February. But actually, I started writing and researching the story well before the tragic news came.
And what did you find out about the conditions in the Russian prison system?
What I was struck by is actually how varied conditions are. So there are some colonies which are not a great place to be, but you can live there. You can have access to electronic mail, can take as little as 3 days for a letter to get there. Some prisoners can order food, have access to some shops. And then there are other prisons which are absolutely horrific. And even within those prisons, conditions can vary. For professional criminals who can be in a common cell to solitary confinement, basically, you have 24 hours. Of those 24 hours, you have 8 hours when you are allowed to use the bed. You're allowed an hour and a half of writing letters, and you're allowed maybe an hour and a half of walks. You're allowed one book. So for 12 hours of a day and more sometimes, you're just by yourself with a book in a cell 2 meters by 3 meters, and you don't see a soul. But the whole thing is deeply humiliating. Men are allowed to shower once a week. Women are allowed to shower twice a week. Some cells have proper toilets, some don't. Some have a sort of hole in the wall. So again, torture and humiliation comes in many different forms. And it can be physical beating and torture and rape. It can be being subjected to total isolation and silence. The purpose of Russian prison, on the whole, is to create fear and to break people's will. And if it doesn't break you, it will kill you. And that's what basically happened to Alexei Navalny. They couldn't break him. They had to kill him.
How did you go about getting a picture of what life looks like in these facilities?
So I spoke to the lawyers who represent political prisoners in particular. I spoke to a wonderful lawyer, Maria Eismond. I spoke to people who actually worked in the system itself. And the most important probably source was the exchange of letters that I had with Vladimir Karamurza, one of Russia's highest profile now political prisoner. He's a journalist, he's a politician. He's been given a longest sentence served by any political prisoner in Russia, 25 years. And he described in detail of what his day looks like. And there are parallels there with Navalny, because Karamurza also had been poisoned twice with Novichok. He also chose to return to Russia. He came back after the war started in April 2022 because he felt it was his duty to speak out against the war inside Russia, not just outside. And just before that, he spoke very openly against Vladimir Putin and his war on CNN.
And so this regime that is in power in our country today, it's not just corrupt, it's not just kleptocratic, it's not just authoritarian. It is a regime of murderers. And it is important to say it out loud. And it is really tragic, frankly, I have no other word for this, that it took a large-scale war in the middle of Europe, which Vladimir Putin is now conducting against Ukraine, for most Western leaders to finally open their eyes to the true nature of this regime.
And I suppose that was enough to get him landed in prison.
Yes, and he knew what he was doing. So he first got charged with spreading fake news, and then very quickly he was then charged with treason for his advocacy of Magnitsky Act, which is an American law that allows sanctions to be placed on people who are involved in corruption and abuses of human rights. So this was an act of revenge, and in Putin's eyes, Karamurza is clearly a traitor.
Arkady, what are the conditions in which Karamurza is kept?
So Karamurza is in a penal colony in Siberia, in a city called Omsk, actually the place where Fyodor Dostoevsky, the famous Russian novelist, was held and which he described in his novels. Karamurza is kept in solitary confinement. He doesn't see anyone. In all the time in prison, he's been allowed one conversation with his family and children. He has three children. He was given 15 minutes, 15 minutes. And this is how Maria Eismond, his lawyer, described this to me.
Other political prisoners do not sit like that. Only Navalny and Karamurza, two of them, were always alone, always in this cell of 2 to 3 meters where you have nothing but the bed that is detached from the wall only in the nighttime when you have your right to sleep, and table and wooden chair, very uncomfortable.
And these are also the facilities where Russia is housing Ukrainian prisoners of war, right?
Yeah, so Russian prison, the traffic goes two ways, if you like. So the Ukrainian prisoners of war are mostly held in the south, close to the Ukrainian borders, all within that Gulag system. But prison is also an important source of recruitment for the battlefield. So the traffic goes both ways. And Maria Eismond, the lawyer I told you about, and we spoke to defense political prisoners and Ukrainian prisoners of war.
I have very good relationship with all the people that I defend. The majority of them become like, and I become a member of their families. That's how they describe it. I mean, imagine you are in a hostile country, in a custody, with no links with your family, no food, no clothes. And then you have somebody who is coming in, giving you, you know, food, clothes, and letters from home. Wouldn't you like this person? Because they like me. That's okay. I like them as well. They're interesting.
Arkady, what was it like to work on this story, especially to have been compiling it when the news of Navalny's death came out?
On the one hand, of course, it has been quite hard. It's not a cheerful subject. At the same time, I'm grateful that I've been able to work on this story, and I'm very grateful to those who have spoken to me and to Vladimir Karamurza, who basically continue to fight and to speak out for all of us, because those human values and that sense of freedom doesn't really have national borders. But also just enormous sense of humility and inspiration coming from people who I've been talking to, corresponding with, who show this extraordinary courage and this extraordinary humanity. What gave me this sense of strength is not that Maria and others harbor some illusion about how quickly this might end or not, but their sense of what is right and what is wrong and their ability to carry on and do the right thing, whatever the conditions are.
Not everyone is afraid, or maybe they are afraid, but overcome their fear.
Do you have hope?
Probably not. I'm not that strong.
If you don't have hope, why are you carrying on doing what you're doing?
Because it's the right thing to do.
Arkady, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's always a pleasure, Ori.
To read Arkady's full investigation, click on the link in the show notes and search for Next Year in Moscow to listen to the bonus and free episode of our acclaimed series on life for those Russians who have fled Vladimir Putin's regime.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.
In 2023, a critical threshold was crossed. For the first time, global temperatures over the year cleared 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. It's a number that many world leaders hoped we would never cross. To have any chance of curbing the warming of the planet, the world needs to get serious about ending its oil addiction. Why on earth is it so hard?
The world needs to move off of oil to deal with climate change, particularly, even though we have a lot of renewables, a lot of new alternatives, the pie keeps growing bigger. And so we have to, in a sense, change the wheels on the bus while the bus is hurtling very rapidly and even accelerating.
Vijay Vaitheeswaran is our Global Energy and Climate Innovation Editor.
The International Energy Agency, which is an official body, says under today's policies, oil use will peak this decade. But not everyone that looks at oil is so sure, because it really looks like year by year, oil demand is actually growing. This year will be record oil demand. And so there is some skepticism about that forecast.
Now, we know that burning fossil fuels is the key factor in rising global temperatures. We've seen the economic chaos that it can cause when that supply is disrupted. And yet it never goes away. Vijay, why is that?
You're quite right. 30 years ago, about 80% of all primary energy in the world economy came from fossil fuels. The figure last year, 80% still. So this is quite persistent. It's very hard to get off of fossil fuels. But in fact, there are three reasons why this is going to be difficult. The first is that oil is really good at what it does. The second is the industry is going to lobby very hard to keep its subsidies and incumbent positions. But the third reason, this is one where there's some hope, that is the policies involved with boosting alternatives, such as electric vehicles and use of efficiency and so on. Those are areas that are not yet aggressive enough, but ones where we could turn our attention to and make more ambitious. So those three areas will determine how fast this goodbye is. And my worry is that if we don't step up the third one, it's going to be a long goodbye.
But Vijay, how did we get here? How did we become so dependent on oil?
Well, we've been living in the age of fossil fuels for a century now. We did have some warning shots. The oil embargo of 1973, roughly 50 years ago, reminded the world that our addiction to oil is a cause of great economic and geopolitical concern. And part of my argument is that as we try to move off of oil in the next few decades, oil could once again gain that possibility of shocking the world economy. And so this is not going to be an easy transition.
You mentioned earlier that a more efficient use of oil could change things. Tell me a bit more about that.
Now, there are a couple of ways to get rid of a problematic fuel, right? One is to find an alternative. In the case of oil, it could be electric vehicles or riding a bicycle. But the second is to use what you do use much more efficiently. And we know from fuel economy standards for vehicles, which have been tried in parts of Europe and Japan, and especially in America, with a law that's known as the CAFE standard, for a decade after the 70s oil shocks, America dramatically improved the fuel economy of its vehicles, even as the economy continued to grow by leaps and bounds. There was no trade-off. And so we need to redouble efforts on efficiency during this transition, even as we ramp up the alternatives to oil, because it's going to take some time to get those alternatives at scale and economic.
Now, where do developing nations come into this?
The thorniest part of the oil endgame is going to be the rise of developing economies. Within 5 years, the biggest new source of oil demand in world markets is going to be India, which has not been a significant factor historically. And soon thereafter, sub-Saharan Africa, as these economies that are enjoying a demographic dividend as they industrialize, as they grow, and the middle classes want things like transport and mobility. The hope is that will be tempered by a switch to electric vehicles, maybe new kinds of efficient modes of transport, public transport. The surprise for many is that China is probably not going to determine the future of oil. And the reason is China's oil consumption is going to peak fairly soon. The country has been aggressively leading electrification in transportation, for example. Over 40% of new cars sold in China this year are going to be electric, which is very good news for the efforts to try to get off of oil. Now, if that model can be copied, if Chinese inexpensive EVs can be sold around the world and not blocked by tariffs, as, for example, America is trying to do now, that would actually be accelerating the transition away from oil. But it's going to be very hard for the rich world, particularly that got rich using oil, to tell India or sub-Saharan African countries, you can't use oil or other fossil fuels as you develop the way we did. And that's why we have to think about possibilities for leapfrogging ahead to cleaner technologies, as well as to possibly much more efficient technologies.
Now, Vijay, I'm Nigerian, historically an oil-producing country, and I'm thinking a little bit self-interestedly here. How are oil producers bracing for this world in flux?
Here, this is going to be some difficult news, I'm afraid. That is, with the exception of a handful of OPEC producers in the Middle East, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and a couple of their neighbors, who happen to have enormous quantities of very inexpensive oil that's easy to lift, very low carbon intensity, and large reserves of it. Most other countries, and there's several dozen countries in Africa, like Nigeria, but also in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, that are going to suffer. The energy transition is going to be pretty hard for the national oil companies in many of those countries because they tend to have higher cost oil. Their oil companies are not at the international level, let's say, as the Saudi Aramco, which is one of the world's leading national oil companies, and they don't have the resources to reinvest in developing alternative energies yet. I think that's the reason why many national oil companies in these countries are going to be in trouble. Possibly two-thirds of the investments they're planning to make in the next 10 years will not make money if the world moves towards net zero and moves off of fossil fuels as people are concerned about climate hope.
How about the private oil companies?
The transition is going to be challenging for big oil companies too, but there are two categories of oil companies, I think, that are emerging in the private sector. Some are going to be out of luck. They're going to do just oil, and I think their hope will be they're going to milk this for as long as they can. I think they're going to be put out of business sooner rather than later. But there are other oil companies that are more farsighted, and they say, let's invest in things like hydrogen or carbon capture and sequestration. Some of them are investing in renewable energies. Some have even put some money towards small marginal nuclear and so on. The companies that are diverting some of their capital expenditures to diversification, I think, stand a better chance of coming out as winners as energy providers, not necessarily oil providers, but some form of energy of the future.
And you mentioned at the very beginning of our chat that the International Energy Agency suspects that peak oil will come this decade. But does everyone share that perspective?
There's a huge debate about when peak oil will come when it comes to peak demand. Certainly those who want to drive a faster transition off of fossil fuels towards a net zero world to deal with climate want to see a peak before the end of this decade and a rapid decline. If you look at the actual policies that countries are implementing, it doesn't quite look like a peak before the end of the decade. Historically, energy transitions from wood to coal to what comes next have taken decades or even a century or more. The world is trying something unprecedented, and how long this will take and how quickly we can move will be for the first time determined by governments, policies, and the choices that each of us makes. And that's why this could be a long goodbye.
Vijay, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
When Amnon Weinstein was growing up, he often wondered where his family was.
Anne Rowe is The Economist's obituaries editor.
Where were his grandparents, his uncles and aunts? His mother then would take a book about Vilnius, which was then in Poland, now in Lithuania, where the family had lived. And she would show him pictures of the Ponari forest on the edge of town. Very tall, silent trees. And she would say, here's where your family is. That forest had once been a beautiful spot in the city. And Amnon's father, who was already very keen on violins, would go there with his friends to play music. He had a faded photograph of him doing that. But then came a terrible massacre by the Nazis over a few years of about 100,000 people there. 70,000 of them were Jews. And so that was where his family were. They were underneath the trees. His father never talked about this. His mother would say no more than showing him the book. Amnon Weinstein just pushed the Holocaust to the back of his mind. He was too young himself to remember it. He was born in 1939, and he was born in Tel Aviv. The family had already emigrated to Israel. So there was no reason for him to dwell on the Holocaust. Until one day in the 1980s, he was faced with a violin that had been through it. At that time, he was helping his father in the violin repair shop. He didn't actually want to be a violin repairer himself, but he was happy to learn the trade. And in came a man with a violin that was dirty, scuffed, cracked. And he said that his grandfather had played it in the concentration camps. He had actually met the prisoners off the train and had walked with them to the gas chambers playing music, which the Nazis, in their perverted way, thought would soothe them on the way to their deaths. Amnon didn't want to take on this job of restoring the violin. But then he thought he would. And when he opened it, he found black powder inside, which was actually human ashes from the crematoria. So he was so profoundly moved by this experience of the violin that he decided he would look for more. And already there was a stash of such violins in the repair shop. There was a whole heap of them in the corner. Because when many of the German emigrants arrived in Palestine, which became Israel, they didn't want to play their violins anymore. Most of the violins were German-made, for a start, and also they'd been their accompaniment through dark days, very dark days in the camps and the ghettos. They couldn't bear the sound of them, and they were wanting to burn them or get rid of them. But Amnon's father, being so fond of violins, couldn't let a violin be burned. But he himself did not know what to do beyond putting them in the corner. His son, however, Amnon, began to collect them. And he found as he did so that each one had a story. He couldn't track every story down, but there were some extraordinary ones. There was one that had been played in the freezing cold in a labor camp. The owner had played Bach partitas on it. There was another one that had been left as a deposit for rent by a young Jewish man who had fled away and never been seen again, and presumably had died in the camps. There was yet another violin that had been thrown out of a train window, with the owner crying to the workers on the line, "Take it, that it may live. Where I'm going, I don't need a violin." So all these stories he gradually gathered and decided that he would restore the violins for their own sake, for the sake of the people who had owned them and had died, and for everyone who had perished in the Holocaust. And he spent months with each one, a year and a half in some cases, painstakingly taking them apart or mending them where they were broken, cleaning off the dirt. He did make one rather startling discovery when he opened a violin to find inside it scrawled the words Heil Hitler, 1936, and a rough swastika. And this, he reckoned, was the German repairer making a mockery of the Jewish owner, because once the violin was closed again, you wouldn't see that this was written inside it. And meanwhile, the owner went on playing it without any idea that he was actually, in a way, promoting Nazism with this instrument. As the years passed, he decided that he would set up an organization that would make sure that these instruments were played again, that they would be given to musicians and incorporated into orchestras, so that the voices of those who'd been silenced would be heard again. He founded an organization called Violins of Hope, and they gave concerts in which the restored violins were handed out to the players. He felt extremely emotional before the early concerts, but it was an extraordinary triumph, and it seemed to him as it went on that it did carry the sound that he was most anxious to hear. And that was the sound of souls speaking like a great forest, like the one in which they had been killed.
Anne Rowe on Amnon Weinstein, who has died aged 84. That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. The show's editors are Chris Impey and Jack Gill. Our deputy editor is Jonjo Devlin, and our sound engineer is Will Rowe. Our senior producers are Rory Galloway and Sarah Larnyuk. Our senior creative producer is William Warren. Our producers are Maggie Kadifa and Benji Guy, and our assistant producer is Henrietta McFarlane, with extra production help this week from Peter Granitz. We'll all see you back here tomorrow for the weekend edition of The Intelligence.
Seven in 10 full-time workers would consider switching jobs for better benefits. Benefit strategies are crucial to building a competitive advantage. But how can employers meet diverse priorities across industries and demographics? Benefits 2.0 from Economist Impact, supported by Nuveen, a TIAA company, explores how benefits empower individuals, elevate companies, and drive the U.S. economy. Search Economist Impact Benefits 2.0 to learn more. Sponsored by Nuveen, a TIAA company.